This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with someone who's been fighting to preserve U.S. coastlines for the past three decades, Mark Massara, a longtime advocate for surfers and coastal preservation. He's currently serving as the VP of Social Responsibility for O'Neill Wetsuits, and we'll get a glimpse into the wetsuit industry and learn what steps are being taken to make it a more sustainable industry. Then Mark will take us through some of the landmark cases he's argued on behalf of organizations like the Sierra Club, and we'll get his thoughts on where things are heading in the fight to keep our beaches and waterways intact. So our guest today on Sea Change Radio is Mark Massara, the General Counsel and VP for Social Responsibility at O'Neill Wetsuits. O'Neill Wetsuits is the inventor of the neoprene wetsuit and also one of the world's largest wetsuit makers. Mark has practiced law in California since 1987. He's served as the General Counsel for the Surfrider Foundation. And he's also been the Director of Coastal Programs for the Sierra Club and has argued numerous cases on their behalf and has served on the board of directors and advisors for numerous nonprofit organizations. Mark, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to join you.
First, tell us a little bit about O'Neill Wetsuits. Your company is
the largest wetsuit manufacturer in North America and inventor of the modern neoprene wetsuit and one of the world's largest wetsuit manufacturers.
When was that?
In the 1950s, Jack O'Neill, our founder, who's 87 years old now, was living right here at Ocean Beach, and these guys were trying to surf, and they were wearing wool and all kinds of stuff, and Jack began to work with those products and eventually arrived at neoprene as an effective water barrier for insulating the body's warmth.
What is O'Neill doing differently than other wetsuit manufacturers? And since you've been there, what have you noticed and what are some of their goals?
Well, we're doing what companies across the world are doing, and that is seeking to take a lead in creating the closely examined company where all of our energy inputs and products on the manufacturing side are as sustainable as possible. And so it's really, for me, it's a two-pronged process where we look at all of our existing energy uses and infrastructure and try to minimize waste and inefficiencies on one side, and then begin to look at all of our products, in our case, neoprene wetsuits primarily, and look for environmental advantages and progress that can be achieved both in the near term and in the long term. And certainly the organic wetsuit, or for that matter, the organic surfboard, is the holy grail for all of the surfing industry around the world. But achievable in the short run, we believe, are recycled wetsuits, for example, and finding ways to collect and reuse old wetsuits. So those are the types of things that we're analyzing and researching right now.
And do you have some kind of a buyback program right now for used wetsuits?
O'Neill has been a leader in this area for literally decades. Jack O'Neill was collecting wetsuits and our founder, Jack O'Neill, who's now 87 years old, has been collecting wetsuits and trying to remanufacture them into pillows and beer holders and such for literally decades. The trick has been that oftentimes you discover that the energy usage involved in collection, transportation, and remanufacturing of the wetsuit material is more energy consumptive and has a larger carbon footprint than doing perhaps nothing. So the trick, I think, in the future is going to be, how can we devise collection systems and reuse strategies that minimize carbon emissions.
Well, what is neoprene for our listeners? And how's it made, and how carbon intensive is it? And is there a wide range of practices in the production that can be more or less sustainable?
Well, traditionally, neoprene is petroleum-based rubber materials that provide superior insulation and body warmth protection while recreating in cold water.
Or keeping your beer cold.
And now with computer bags and all kinds of things. It's soft, it's a cushion, it's insulation. And that's essentially what you're looking for when you wrap your body in something to go out into cold water, whether you're surfing or diving or just playing in the ocean. For many years now, O'Neill and most of the rest of the wetsuit industry has been using limestone instead of petroleum. So we've been off petroleum-based wetsuit manufacturing processes for many years now. But from our perspective, that's not enough to brag about. Just because we're using limestone, because in fact, limestone is a mined mineral material and there's carbon footprint involved in that process. There are wetsuit manufacturing companies that, make environmental claims related to limestone-based wetsuits. But the fact of the matter is we think there's a lot more that can be done, and we're looking to do that.
What made you passionate about environmental issues, and why do you do what you do?
I'm no different than a 10-year-old child in Louisiana today experiencing the massive BP oil spill. When I was a child growing up in Santa Barbara, California, a company by the name of Union Oil, later renamed to Unocal, Union Oil of California, now part of Chevron, experienced an enormous blowout on a brand new deep sea oil derrick that was at that time 2,000 feet, a lot more shallow than the current spill that BP is experiencing in the Gulf. But that spill leaked out over 100,000 gallons of oil, about the amount of oil that BP is leaking every single day at this point. But it was enough to cover thousands and thousands of square miles of coast in central and southern California, blackened beaches on the central coast in Goleta and Santa Barbara, and I think deeply influenced everyone that experienced that oil spill, the oil on the beach, the tarred birds, the massive and catastrophic impacts to marine resources and marine mammals, fisheries, and tourism, our economy. That oil spill, followed by the burning of prominent polluted rivers throughout the United States and other environmental problems and pollution throughout the United States, starting in 1970, led to the passage of a series of environmental laws that still stand today as some of the world's premier environmental protection laws. My own experience with the Unocal oil spill led me to want to become involved in protection of coastal environments and the economies and communities and health and welfare that are supported by those healthy coastal environments. And I went to law school and joined different nonprofits and have worked on these coastal protection issues for the last 40 years.
Were you already a surfer when the Unocal spill occurred?
Well, just about. I was probably a little young. I think I started surfing in about fifth grade. My fifth grade elementary school teacher gave my best friend and I a surfboard, and we used to take it down to the area where the University of California at Santa Barbara is located today, and surf out there. And that's how it all started. And my love of the ocean and my continued interest in surfing and diving and beachcombing are the source of my continuing passion for this work.
That's longtime coastal advocate and VP of Social Responsibility at O'Neill Wetsuits, Mark Massara, on Sea Change Radio. Now more from our conversation with Mark Massara. Can you talk about some of the Clean Water Act cases that you've argued?
Well, I graduated from law school in 1987 and began working almost immediately with a quixotic surfing organization called Surfrider Foundation, a nonprofit environmental group that was formed in 1987 and was dedicated to protecting coastal environments and wave riding areas around the world. We very quickly became aware of a massive continuing ocean pollution situation way up in Northern California in Humboldt County, where two pulp mills were operating, taking wood chips and converting them into paper products, and were discharging dioxin-laden toxic water to the tune of 40 million gallons a day right into a premier surfing environment near the mouth of the Humboldt Bay entrance. We launched a Clean Water Act case against those two pulp mills in 1989 that quickly became one of the largest and ultimately the largest water pollution case ever prosecuted in federal court here in the United States. And we did that case in San Francisco from 1989 to 1991, and it resulted in over 40,000 violations of the Clean Water Act being recognized and accounted for, and in the end, a $150 million settlement. After the case against the pulp mills in Humboldt County, I joined Sierra Club and became director of their coastal programs, and began to work with Sierra Club groups and chapters and literally hundreds of other small environmental organizations and thousands of activists up and down the California coast on hundreds of coastal protection, development, pollution, and beach access issues and cases. And that became a platform for having the opportunity and the privilege to work in front of the California Coastal Commission over many years. And our organizing work at Sierra Club brought tens of thousands of people to very large hearings, and we're able to educate not only the public, but also public officials and politicians about the public's desire to see coastal resources and California beaches protected from things like oil spill and massive oil spills, toxic enterprises, and developmental sprawl. So in the late 1990s, the Hearst Corporation, one of America's largest publishing operations, proposed to build a series of resorts along 18 miles of Central Coast in and around the community of San Simeon and around the famous Hearst Castle with golf courses, houses, and resorts. Would have wreaked havoc on a very fragile and culturally iconic and environmentally scenic habitat area. We were able to organize, as I said, thousands of people to attend those hearings. And in 1998, the Coastal Commission denied the Hearst resorts and set in motion a process whereby now the vast majority of that ranch has been permanently protected in agricultural easements. And public access is forever protected along all 18 miles of that coast. That, at the time, was one of the larger land-based coastal protection victories ever achieved. Thereafter, we began to work with the Pebble Beach Company that is owned by Peter Uberoth and Clint Eastwood and some other prominent sports and entertainment figures on a plan where they wanted to chop down at least 18,000 native Monterey pine trees for additional resorts, golf, and houses. They would have filled in wetlands and basically eliminated the last remaining native stands of Monterey pines along the California coast in the Del Monte Forest in Monterey County. We worked for about 5 years with the company on that proposal before they finally insisted on moving forward. And in In 2007, the California Coastal Commission denied that project, despite the fact that Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and most other major politicians in the state of California were supporting Clint Eastwood and the Pebble Beach Company. That was the sheer importance of thousands of members of the public and good science being brought to bear on an otherwise politically dangerous potential development situation.
Now that you're in the corporate world and after 20 plus years of from the advocate side, how do you see the loggerheads that we're at in terms of corporate America and our environment evolving?
Well, first of all, there's always going to be a myriad of stupid, ill-conceived development and pollution ideas. There is never going to be a shortage of BPs or other companies or would-be developers that are trying to extract short-term profits through exploiting and destroying nature. So there's never been... there will never be the lack of a need for local participation in safeguarding natural resources. On the other hand, I think there's just great demand for progressive entrepreneurs and corporations with new ideas to support our new economy and to develop sustainable technologies and processes that are going to be resistant to climate change and sea rise. What continues to interest me is the way that markets and politicians, and in large part our communities, live in denial of what's coming. And what's coming is dramatic change in not just weather patterns, but our everyday lives in ways that we can barely begin to conceive of today. For example, in the last 100 years, there was documented about 8 inches of sea rise in California and around the San Francisco Bay. We've had a hard time dealing with that. We're busy building levees throughout not just the San Francisco Bay region, but all the way inland to the Delta and Sacramento and south on down towards the Central Valley in order to deal with just that minimal, minuscule bit of sea rise. Well, it's now plain to scientists that are analyzing this that in the next 80 to 100 years, we're likely to experience 4.5 feet or more of sea rise. And that puts in grave danger hundreds of miles of roadways, dozens of sewage treatment plants, international airports, thousands of homes, and our way of life as we know it in the Bay Area and San Francisco Bay Area region. Yet, what are we doing about this? Nothing. It's business as usual. Each and every month, all of the same sorts of development is proposed and considered with the very same setbacks, which are insufficient today and are going to be really insufficient down the road. We can't simply build seawalls and avoid this situation. We are going to have to implement adaptive strategies, which often comes down to moving back. And yet instead of moving back, in the next 20 years, there's 20,000 houses proposed for low-lying former wetlands all around the San Francisco Bay.
That's Mark Massara, longtime coastal advocate and vice president of social responsibility at O'Neill Wetsuits.
Oh, what does the deep sea say? What does the deep sea say? It moans, it groans, it splashes and it foams, and it rolls on its weary way.
Now more from our conversation with Mark Massara of O'Neill Wetsuits. One of the strategies from the other side, the non-environmental side of arguing why something should be implemented or built or continued in terms of dumping or development, the strategy tends to be focusing on an anecdotal, on one thing. So they can make fun of, well, it's just this batch of trees, or there's it's one species of spotted owls, and owls are not as important as people. Each little flag we throw up is just a bump in the road, it seems, at some point.
I like to refer to this as death by a thousand cuts. Each person says, my project is not going to be the cause of global warming, so don't hold me accountable for that. Just let me eliminate this little bit of nature, because I'm going to build a really neat big box mall that everybody really wants. And we do that over and over and over again. And in the case of the California coast, we've lost 98% of our coastal wetlands. Those, in fact, are the lungs and the nurseries of our fisheries and our economic wealth along the coast. And we're literally killing the goose that lays the golden eggs. And our hope is that people will wake up to this sort of thing and recognize that long-term strategies are good business. And this is common sense, that we do need politicians to think ahead and not just do the most expedient thing possible and put off all of the difficult decisions until they're out of office.
As a lifelong surfer, if you can compare what you saw when you were in fifth grade to what you see today, have you noticed any change in some of your favorite spots in terms of water temperature, marine life, and other kind of degradation?
Yeah, I think this cuts both ways. When I was younger, we were just going through a horrendous experience with DDT, a chemical that was thought to be super good at killing bugs in the 1960s. And it turned out that it was so good that it not only killed bugs, but marine mammals, dolphins, pelicans, bald eagles, all of our marine mammals and much of the bird life in Southern California was going extinct. Coupled with a long drought in the 1980s, led to a dramatic decrease in raptor populations, hawks and so forth. Much of the time when I was growing up and beginning to go surfing, we didn't see dolphins and hawks and pelicans and these sort of important keystone species. Otters, for example, were nearly extinct. Today, up and down the coast, because of aggressive protection measures and a fair bit of rain over the last few years, these populations are on the rebound and are expanding. And there's nothing more exciting about going into the ocean and experiencing not just the joy of riding waves, but the joy of seeing wildlife. That's why I go surfing, is to be in wilderness. To the idea of surfing in a wave pool for me is not exciting. I go into the ocean because there are great white sharks and because there is some element of wilderness and the unexpected, potential danger. That's part and parcel to the whole experience and for me, the fun of it. That's worth fighting for. And the reality is, the BP oil spill, if that were to happen on the California coast, would be having the same impact on our pelican populations and wildlife species as it's currently having in the Gulf. And they may never recover from what's going on there right now.
Right now we have a global issue. It's not just a California or a Gulf Coast issue. What do you see as some of the best solutions out there?
We're fortunate in some ways because here in California we have a developed infrastructure of laws and public participation in coastal development and pollution decision-making. around the world, that's not the case. In most places around the world, the public or the surfing community has very little input on seawalls and pollution, new development, industry. I spend a fair bit of time working with activists around the world devising strategies to deal with those problems. I'm on the board of advisors of an organization called Save the Waves that's dedicated to helping surfers around the world mobilize public support to put demand on foreign politicians to protect coastal environments and wave riding areas in at least a dozen different countries. But the problems are massive, and the solutions start here at home. The evidence is in, you know, the California coastal zone is the world's most expensive, most desirable, most fought over dirt. And that is because we have struggled to try to care for that environment. And what people should come to realize is that rather than being a burden, those careful deliberations over what to build and how much to allow in coastal environments ultimately enhances and protects the economy.
And if you were a 10-year-old boy, again, somewhere in, or let's say you were 18 and you were in Nigeria and you loved surfing and you saw these, the devastation that it was wreaking on your coastal community, what would you, what would be some of the first steps that that 18-year-old kid could do to try to get these bigger than imaginable forces out of their backyard?
Well, certainly, I mean, the message is that David and Goliath victories are possible, that organizing your community is critical, that getting up off the couch and participating in decision-making is imperative. Companies and polluters always want you to think that you can't win, don't bother, you know, just go home and watch television. The only thing I can say for certain is that if you don't try, you can't win. The flip side of that is that almost anything is possible. And we've seen time and time again that a small group of really dedicated people can achieve permanent, lasting environmental protections and victories. I'm optimistic. You know, not foolishly optimistic that I or any one person can save the world. I'm optimistic about what one person can do in their community and the cumulative effect of that working together to protect nature and the effects that we can have for our families and for the future.
Well, Mark Massara, the General Counsel and VP for Social Responsibility at O'Neill Wetsuits, we really appreciate you taking the time to walk us through some of the good works you're doing and highlight some of the issues that, that all of us need to be aware of.
Hey, thanks so much. I really appreciate it, and go to the beach soon.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our theme music is by Sanford Lewis. Additional music by Moore Chiba, The Clash, Alex Wise, and Doc Watson. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.